This is the Self-Taught or Not podcast with
Dylan Israel
and Eric Hanchett, where we teach you the do's and don'ts of software development from two software development professionals, one self-taught and one not.
All right, so this is a special episode. It'll be our season two finale, so try to hold back those tears. And what we're going to talk about is what it's like being on the other side of the table. I was on LinkedIn earlier and I saw this meme with it where the interviewer asks, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And the interviewee responds back, in your chair, but asking better questions. And I thought, I'm going to use that one day and make sure that they actually think it's funny so I get the job. And also I said, why don't we talk about what it's like to be the interviewer and make sure that you know, we can excel at that, because it's just as important, especially as you go and progress your career.
Yeah, I think we've all been on that other side of the table where we're getting grilled and we're nervous and we don't know what to do. We don't know the answers to all the questions. We have the anxiety, imposter syndrome comes over. But I think it'd be fun, and I think this is a good topic that you came up with, Dylan, just talk about the other side. What's it? What do the interviewer, how do they feel? And what can we learn from our interviewees that we do? And also, just talk about our own experiences of how we deal with interviewing people and how we handle that. I've had the pleasure and responsibility of interviewing quite a few people over my career, a lot recently in my current job, but also before then, kind of a few other places. It's weird. In some companies I've been in, they've only allowed like management or very specific few people to do interviews. And then I've been at other companies that pretty much say, oh, you're going to be on a team with this person. Maybe you should interview them. What has your experiences been like?
Yeah, I would say at the company level, it kind of depends on the organization that you work for. So many places are very specific about their culture. You know, you can't see this, but I'm doing air quotes because I think corporate culture in general, it's all just like lies and manipulation. I just think, anyhow, that's a side tangent. But I would say the smaller the company, the more hands-on that organizations want to be about who gets hired. But as you go to medium and large-sized companies, I think more and more the upper management doesn't have the time to deal with that many employees coming in and out. And two, there's a little bit of an understanding that these are the people who are going to be working with you. And it's important that you think they're a good fit for the team. And I think that's one of the items that I think is most important, is that the people who do the job think you're qualified to come in and do the job.
I like that. You know, it's interesting. I really like always, like any, I remember even starting my career off in doing tech support. Anytime they were hiring people, I was always like, hey, I can help hire people. Like, bring me into the conversation. Because those are the people that I'm going to be working with, and I'd like to have a say on who we hire and who we don't hire. But it feels like it's almost like a privilege in some companies where it's like, ooh, we only allow these people to do interviews and everybody else can. I think if in a perfect world, all your employees should have a chance to interview people. Like, I think that's great, because then you get diverse opinions of people. I mean, we don't all think alike and we don't all act alike. We don't all look alike. So why not have multiple people from different backgrounds interview people? And that way you can kind of have a better judgment of who you want to hire. I think that's makes a lot of sense. And going back to what you said about, these are the people that you're going to be working with every day. And if these are the people you're going to work with every day, then yeah, you should have an idea of who they are. Now, let's keep this honest, that not everyone knows how to interview and not everyone understands what they're looking for. So I think there needs to be some training involved. Like, I don't think anyone should just do an interview without kind of giving the guidelines of what questions to ask and how to evaluate someone. And also there is a point in all organizations where it's just too difficult, I would say, to have, there's just so many applicants and so many people coming in and so many interviews. There's like just a constant amount of people leaving and coming in every year. That's impossible to, you know, have a super consistent way you interview people, and you can't always have the same people interview people. But I think you can strive to do okay. I mean, it's never going to be perfect. Like, the interviewing process in any organization is never going to be perfect. There are going to be people that end up you end up hiring that doesn't work out. There are going to be people that you don't hire that you probably should have hired. And it's just, it's like an imperfect process. And we're not going to get into all the different ways you interview people, but I think that starting off with just having multiple eyes and multiple people looking at candidates is a good idea.
Yeah, and I think with the FANG companies, what I've read and have heard when I've interviewed with them is that they go through interview training a lot of times. Sometimes you'll even have like a ghost interviewer sit on the outside and watch the main interviewer work with you. And the idea there being is that it is a skill, right? Being able to talk with people and being able to see where their knowledge is or isn't is a skill that you need to have. And you need to do it in a way that's actually nice, right? And is you know, I've had interviews with people who have just like made me feel like a dumpster fire, and I've had interviews that I've done similar in, but they maybe got me unstuck on something and they did very well. And oftentimes when I have these interviews, that even if I do poorly in them, I'll respond back to the recruiter and say, hey, you know, I think I did mediocre in the interview, but the interview process was good, to let them know that they're on the right path.
Yeah, it's really easy too. If you're on the other side and you're getting interviewed and you don't get the job, you can be like, "Well, that interview sucked. Those people don't know what they're doing." But it's hard to like take a critical eye and be like, "Well, I know I didn't do that great in the interview, but that interview was pretty good. Like that guy was nice." And I think I wish there was ways, and maybe this is the way Google and Facebook does it, where they have shadow interviews where people watch you do the interview. Maybe that's the way you evaluate if you're a good interviewer. That if, you know, other people can grade you, because you don't want to be graded by the person that's actually doing, like receiving the interview, because it's going to be certainly biased if they get the job or not. I think it takes a really big person to be like, hey, I didn't get that job, but you know, that was a great interview. I mean, most people will be like, you know, they're going to try to blame someone else if they don't get it. They don't get the job. I think it's just human nature. But yeah, I think that idea of someone watching you do the interview is a good way to do it. I don't think I'm trying to think back of all the times I've done interviews. I think I've done group interviews, like where it's me and two other people interviewing someone, but I don't think I've ever had someone like critique the way I do interviews. And I just want to make one point here, and I don't want to get into this subject, but there is biases out there. I think we all have them. And there's a thing to say about diversity and trying to hire the right people for the right role, but also try to hire a diverse workforce. And I think definitely like good organizations, when they teach the people doing the interviews, they bring that up. Like that should be a conscious bias, and that we should call it out, and that we need to put together our interviews in such a way that it kind of promotes diversity without, you know, just handing jobs to people that are unqualified.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about actually interviewing, right? So, you know, you had mentioned about making sure that we sort of give everyone a fair shot. And to that point, one thing that I do is that if I know ahead of time of what role I'm interviewing with, assuming it's not the first interview, by the second one, I have an idea of what I'm, you know, hiring for, is I actually have my questions listed out ahead of time. And although I don't ask the exact same question to every applicant, of the 20, 30 or 40 questions, I sort of have different groups on there. And I'll ask similar questions for every applicant because I want to get a baseline of where they are in comparison to other people. And so sometimes you'll do 2-3 interviews a day. And it's not always necessarily about getting it all right, but seeing how you compare to other applicants is just as important.
Having like a paper and pencil or some kind of note-taking application that you can take to like physically write down notes during the interview is really helpful. And I've noticed too, when you ask, maybe you have the same 20, 30 questions you asked each candidate, but you'll find out that candidates have a lot of different ways they answer questions. So you may have one candidate come in and give you the textbook answer for it. And then you have but that's very rare. Like sometimes you get like that perfect candidate that has the textbook answer, especially for these technical topics. But sometimes you'll get like answers that are not quite right, or like they're 90% of the way. And so just like by writing notes down and be like, well, yeah, he sort of understood this concept, but not quite right. Like, for example, I might ask a question on the box model, which in CSS is a pretty common, it's pretty common CSS. It talks about margins and padding and and positioning a little bit and how that relates and borders and things like that. So if you can have someone talk intelligently about that, they may bring up, there's something called margin and there's something called padding and the padding is inside an object and margin's outside and you can position it this way. And they may kind of like, but they may forget some key points and you kind of have to like not just discount the whole answer because they forgot a few key points, but you might be able to kind of still give them kind of a grade on that by making notes. That's helpful. Do you ever have that issue where you get a candidate that sort of gets it right, but not quite?
Yeah.
Is that more common?
Yeah, I think it's, it's not only sort of gets it right, but doesn't go into as much detail. And so I press them to see, I think a good question, and this isn't always the case with certain things, is one that requires multiple levels to see how detailed. Like you could say, hey, tell me about asynchronous programming, for instance. What do you know about it in JavaScript? And you can keep pushing to see where their knowledge ends. And so if I push and they don't have anything else to say or they say something incorrectly, usually what I do, because I have this printout, I print it out for each interview. I give them a point, a zero if it's wrong, half if it's partially correct, and one if they did an excellent job. And that way I can kind of have an idea of, and it's not like this, oh, you got to get like a 7 to pass or anything, but more so. So it's hard to take notes so detailed while still paying attention. I simply score based on how I felt at the moment they answered the question, and then I reference back to it.
It's probably better than the way I'm doing it. I've done a little bit of scoring, but a lot of times it also comes down to like a gut feeling. Like you can tell after 2 or 3 questions if they sort of get it right or they're completely wrong. They're like, maybe this guy isn't quite right. But you got to be very careful with your gut feeling because your gut feeling might have some biases. So being able to prepare empirical evidence is much more reliable. So if you could be like, hey, I asked these guys 3 questions. They got a 0, 0 and a half a point. That's better than like, hey, I asked this guy 3 questions and he kind of didn't get it right. And I don't think he's the right fit. But I think like more data that you can put down and more evidence that the person didn't get it right, either by a scoring system or by writing down their answers and evaluating it later if they're right or wrong, is a good choice. It's funny. I've also had interviews too where you get like the fast talkers. And I'm one of those people that kind of, if you listen to this podcast, sometimes I get into pretty fast rants, but a lot of times I'm slow and methodical with my answers. So I'll be asking questions slowly like this, and they'll just rattle off an answer. And you could tell like they don't quite understand it, or they'll add in like technical jargon that just kind of throws me off a little bit. And you almost have to go back through and then like, what did you mean by this? What did you mean by throwing in this technical jargon word that doesn't really make sense? It just kind of happens. And also, I'll give the benefit of the doubt to the people I'm interviewing because I know they're nervous and it's not always easy to come up with these answers off the top of your head. And frankly, some people think that these type of interviews, just asking people technical questions, is a bad interview because they're like, why can't I just Google it all? But my answer to that is always, like, you should know these, like, these are fundamental questions that you should have learned while working with these technologies. And I don't ask gotcha type questions that you can, tell me the distance between these 2 points on this page or what's the exact line height you should use. I don't like ask specific Googleable type trivia questions. I try to ask fundamental questions.
Yeah, and I think that's crucial, which is like in the async example is a typical type of question that I'll ask. But I've been in interviews where someone has literally asked me, what is the Angular CLI command to update from one version of a component to the next or some crap like that? And I was like, I don't know, man. I barely use the CLI. What do you want me to do? Like, I create a component and I create a project. I press ng serve to run it. Like, what are you asking stupid questions for? Like, but I get the intent of you need to ask more fundamental questions. And, one thing that, I like to ask more technology based questions. Well, my tech lead, when he does interviews, he asks about more higher level things like, maybe, you know, talking about, hey, can you design the service given this criteria? What would your schema look like? How do you test your code? You know, what do you do for testing? And, you know, do you have any quality control standards and things like that that are a little bit higher level? Because that's, everyone's going to interview slightly different, but that's what's important to him. The assumption, and this happens a lot too when you interview for a lot of these FAANG companies, is like you may be going in for like a front end role, but they're not going to ask you anything about HTML, CSS, or JavaScript. They're going to ask you about what they perceive to be fundamentals, you know, space-time complexity, big O notation, algorithms. So, you know, every organization is going to be slightly different, but I like to make sure, at least with the people that I'm interviewing, that they understand the core foundational languages. I don't really ask questions about like frameworks and things like that.
Yeah, so long as you can answer the fundamental questions for whatever tech, I think you can ask some framework questions, long as it's based on like the fundamentals of that framework. Like someone might ask you, what are some lifecycle hooks in Angular or React or Vue? I think those things are okay to talk about, or how you like what kind of testing libraries are you used to, or what have you used. But I think that's a good point you made, is to not, and kind of what I was talking about before, is to keep it to the fundamentals, and then don't ask you those gotcha Google type interview questions, but also kind of broaden it up, like ask a little bit more system architecture type questions, like how would you architect this service, or how would you handle this problem? So I think maybe a combination of both is good. And it's good to be maybe do an interview with multiple people and have one person be like that. Here, let me ask you the fundamental questions of Angular or React or whatever. And then here, this person's going to ask you more like, what's your thought process behind designing a component, or you're designing this feature here. So having multiple viewpoints, I think would be helpful, and you can kind of more find out what the candidate knows or not. Because at the end of the day, what you don't want to do is hire someone that just like gets lost on the first day, like never worked with services and barely worked with React or doesn't remember anything. Maybe they worked in Angular or Vue 2 years ago and they don't remember anything. So I think that's the risk of just hiring someone that's going to be a huge slog on the team instead of a bonus.
Yeah, and when you're interviewing, I always make sure to ask something other than just a question about, you know, the technologies and so that. I look at their resume and I see one thing that interests me before the interview, and I'll highlight it. I usually print out their resume and I'll highlight it, and I say, I'm going to ask them to go into detail about this project, or to tell me more about a side project or their last workplace, about this specific bullet point that they spoke to, and see, one, if they can speak intelligently about it, it seems to be true. A lot of people lie on their resume. And two, just to see their level of you know, participation. And I always try to make at least one question based off that, because so often you get into these interviews and you just go straight into technical mode. Okay, we're going to talk about JavaScript. We're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about system architecture, that you don't even really talk about their experience.
That's a good tip. I would say, though, be careful, because I have seen some resumes that have been done through recruiters and recruitment agencies and things like that. And what they'll do is they'll take like if you were looking for a job now and you went to a recruiting agency, they may take your resume and redo it. And what they do is they take all the technologies that you've ever worked with or even touched, and they list it on their resumes. So that way, that it gets through some, you know, through whatever HR gatekeeper is out there, or maybe some of these companies have, they just take all the resumes and they put it through some app to like rank people, and they use the keyword searches and everything. And I've seen resumes that are just lists of keywords like JavaScript, HTML, CSS, jQuery, Angular, React, Vue. I mean, every like RxJS, and they're just lists of words. And so like you're going to the candidate and you'll be like, hey, can you tell me like about jQuery? It's on your resume. And like, oh yeah, I worked on that 3 years ago and I don't remember too much about it, but it's this. So I just depends on the resume. But if this is the resume coming from the person, they handcrafted themselves and they put a bunch of different technologies. Most likely they don't know all those technologies, or at least not very well. And that might be a little bit of a red flag. I always think that when I put together my resume, I only put in technologies that I can like just actually talk about. But I found in the real world, especially working with recruitment agencies, that's not always the case.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. I only put things on that I think are relevant, or for that matter, technologies I want to work in. So like, even though my very first job worked in PHP and MySQL, you won't find it on my resume because I don't even want to be considered for roles that work in that. Yeah, it's sort of a strange game working with recruiters at times, because you do get caught in the like playing the game a little bit. And, you know, in the case where I've asked that, because that situation has happened where, you know, you ask about something and they say, oh, hey, you know, I had minimal participation, this or that. And then I would, you know, usually how I follow up is like, well, tell me about something similar where you had participation in this, or a technology that you do feel confident about.
Yeah, that's good. I would say, I know a lot of I'm just going to move on to another topic kind of related to that with resumes. I know a lot of resume advice out there says to make sure that you 100% proofread your resume, make sure you get rid of every single typo, that you keep it to one page. A lot of them recommend maybe even to put your picture on it. But what I've seen in the real world is that most people, a lot of companies, not most, but a lot of companies I've worked with just look at the experience, and they don't necessarily care if it's two or three pages long. They don't care if you have your picture on it or not. And I've never looked through a resume and found a typo and been like, yep, get this off the pile. Then again, I haven't been at companies that get thousands and thousands of resumes. So maybe that's the normal for those companies, that like you put in your resume and there's 10 other, you know, there's 100 other people applying for that job. But for me, it's more about like, what have they done in the past? What's their experience? Who they are? Than it is, you know, nitpicking every, you know, little thing on there about having a typo and then excluding them. I don't know. What do you think?
I think those types of issues are usually things that HR cares about more than devs. I think devs are a little bit less neurotic about those sorts of things, but that's not our world, right? By the time someone gets to a dev to be interviewed, they've essentially already been approved by HR. And so HR has gone through 100, 200 resumes. And so they're a little annoyed. But yeah, I don't go and nitpick through the resume. It does remind me, though, that of a random thing that happened to me, where I was doing a video on resumes for the YouTube channel, and I changed the phone number, right? I didn't want people calling me, obviously, from the internet. And then I forgot to change it back when I downloaded it again. I started applying for jobs at the time. So I was sending out this for weeks, like a resume with the wrong phone number on it. So you definitely want to be a little safe with that and double check it. But yeah, generally speaking, you should be proofreading your resume. And I know for the most part, minus that occasion, I usually will ask a girlfriend or a friend or something, take a look and see and go from there, because it's a stupid reason to get kicked out, and it's avoidable with a little bit of effort and energy. And, you know, we've talked about this again and again, but looking for a job is just as much as a job. And like, you have to really approach it with that mentality.
I guess I didn't think of it that way. I think like when it gets to me, it probably has been gone through a few times, but at least for me, when it at least gets to me, that wouldn't be a criteria that I would care about is some of those things. But you're right. Could maybe HR would be. Yeah, definitely. Kudos on the getting extra people to look at your resume. Also, I think as an interviewer, you should take a few moments, if you can, to look at the resume before you talk to the person. Look up their GitHub if they have a GitHub listed. You know, maybe download one of their projects, or at least take a look at one of their projects. Get you an idea of who they are. And this is really great for new developers that are coming in. If you make it past the HR stage and you get to actually interview with me, I'm going to take a few moments to look at your GitHub repo. I'm going to take a few moments to take a look at your projects. Now, I think you should make this as easy as possible for the interviewer. So a lot of people can think like, oh, why don't they just download all my projects and compile them and run them? And why do they ask me questions? I've done projects on these. But you got to realize, even when it gets to the point of an actual interviewer, they might have like four, five, six, seven interviews, and they don't have time to like download all your repos and compile them and run them. So if you can make like a website, like a portfolio site that actually has the websites and projects that you have worked on listed and compiled and working, that would make life much easier. I will say though, when I'm hiring for senior engineers, like having a portfolio is like nowhere near a requirement at all. Like if I see you have 10, 15 years of experience in all these different technologies, I'm going to go off of the answers you give me. We don't do take-home projects, although I've worked at some companies that have. I'm like, those are what's going to base it. I hardly ever look at portfolios or personal websites or anything like that.
Yeah, I'm always more intrigued by personal projects than anything else. And so like that to me, especially just because it's such a big part of my life, it makes me more interested in candidate. But there's plenty of developers that I've interviewed who don't have that, but still get interviews because it's not always what, you know, HR cares about. They care about skills and years of experience more than anything else. So you can't really control that. Like if it was up to me, and I was just talking earlier today with a colleague of mine, it's like, we should give more junior developers shots and, you know, go from there. But most organizations, they want to hire people who in their eyes are already up to the task. But, you know, I like junior developers because they have room for growth and they don't have as many bad practices and their opinions are more fluid than senior developers. As we sort of grow, we continue to have our own standards and things like that. And we get a little bit more closed off. While if you're working with juniors, you can sort of mature them in that direction. But that's when those projects and those portfolios matter the most, in my opinion.
Yeah. I think it's a time thing too. Like they look at projects that are due and they know if they have a junior developer, it's going to like, they're like twice as slow as a senior developer, or at least not all of them. Some of them are super fast, but by the most part, you're going to have to spend a lot more time with them. So it's not very, I don't know, not a lot of people love that. Not a lot of companies like that idea, which is too bad. I'm the same thing. Like I'm in the same boat. If a great candidate came along that was a little more junior, I would love to interview them, but a lot of companies don't have that option or they don't look for those people. What else do you look for during your interviews? Like if you were, what other tips would you have for interviewees being an interviewer?
So when I push in on some of these questions where it's like, oh, you got this part right. If I push a second level and they completely get flustered or they won't try on any of the questions, usually this is happening. It's more on like algorithm type problems where they won't even try. I've had people say, I don't know, I'm not even gonna, and I try to lead them, but they won't even put their first foot forward. There are certain things that I'll just eliminate a candidate for, and not giving something a shot is one of them, because it just means like, oh, well, what happens when you get stuck? Like, or senior developers who have years and years of experience, but are still, how do I put this? They're still not quite there mentally, in the sense of, you know, I think a lot of us suffer from imposter syndrome, but at 10 years experience, like, I want you to be confident enough that it doesn't show in the interview. Like that concerns me a bit, because being a developer is very stressful. And like, I need my teammates to be able to handle stress. Cause if you can't, it's going to reflect poorly on the team. It's just going to make my workload worse.
Yeah, I agree. Totally. It's one of those things that I've talked about imposter syndrome several times, and I'm the one of those rare people that I feel like I'm pretty confident in what I do and I don't get imposter syndrome often. I do get anxiety when I have different deadlines coming up or there's different things that I don't know how to fix, but I'm pretty confident that I can figure it out and I don't have this feeling like I don't belong or something. So it's hard for me to really relate, but if that comes out really, like if you're really vulnerable during an interview, it's not the time in an interview to be vulnerable. And in life, I think in life in general, we like to see confident people. Like confidence is important. And being not confident makes you look doesn't have a very good look for you. And there's times where you should not be confident. There's times that you should be definitely very humble, that you should be very vulnerable, that you should tell everyone, like if you're making a connection, like you're dating. Like if you're dating someone, yeah, you tell them, you know, your vulnerabilities. It's a way to connect. But in an interview, that's not where you're supposed to do this. And I've definitely had times where people have kind of, I've felt like they've lacked a little bit of that confidence, and that has hurt their prospects. But it's also to the point you don't want to get too cocky, because with confidence, if you get too confident, it makes you look cocky. And then that's just like the total opposite. And that really, really can turn off some interviewers if they find out that you act like you're the bee's knees and you just try to act like you know everything. Like that's too much. But having some confidence is very important. I would also say attitude. Just to go off of Dylan's point here, the attitude is really important. I've been in that same side. I remember doing an interview at a big FANG type company. And at one point they asked me at the end of the interview how I did. And I'm like, oh, I just did horrible. I know I didn't do right. And I just realized right after I said that, like I kind of just showed them all my cards. Like at that point, the interviewer might've thought I did great. But now since I have vocalized that I did terrible, I didn't think I did very well. It made me sound like that became reality. But if I would have just gone in there and be like, you know, there were some things I didn't know, but now I think I did good. Even if I didn't do good, I think that would have been a better answer than coming in and being like, oh, I did terrible. Like that's worse. And I think that showed like a kind of not a great attitude.
Yeah. And I think attitude's important as well as being realistic. Another thing I always like to ask at the end of the interview is what someone bring, if it's not apparent. So like, hopefully you've made it apparent by the end of the interview, but I try to find out if I'm hiring for my team, what unique thing you bring to the team. Cause I think it's important for managers and devs to understand that when you hire somebody that they need to add something new and not just be another person, I guess. And that will make the whole team grow because of it. And so if it's not apparent, I'll ask, like, you know, what makes you unique? What do you bring to the table? And I try to find that out throughout the interview by reading their resume and interacting with them. But I like to ask that question because that's something that means a lot to me when I'm interviewing candidates.
I love it when I interview someone and I could tell that they know a topic better than I, and that they really bring something unique to what I'm doing. So, because as a developer, there's so many different technologies, there's so many different techniques, there's really cool things coming out every day. But if you know somebody, if you hire somebody like, hey, this guy is an expert in CSS animation, like, wow, that's kind of a cool thing. Like, I'm not an expert in CSS animation, bring him on the team. Or just like having those things that you can kind of point to, like, yeah, this guy brings a different perspective, or this guy has really strong strengths in these places, and that will really help us. That really helps goes a long way. As long as they can pass, the caveat being is that they can pass the basic technical interview questions that I ask. They can be really good at, you know, jQuery or something, but if they can't answer what a box model is, they probably aren't going to have much of a chance getting through the interview.
Yeah. You don't want their strength to be, well, what I'll bring to the table is all your other developers will feel much better about their skill set because I'm so terrible. So there's a very practical aspect of like, you have to have the skills to pay the bills. I think that's what the kids are saying.
It's funny too, because you the recommendation advice you hear out there is like, you want to be on the team where you're the dumbest person, so that way you can grow the most out of everyone in your team. But if you flip that around, no one wants to hire the dumbest person on their team. You want to hire someone at the same skill levels as everyone else on the team, or if they're newer, just a little bit underneath the skill points or skills. Once again, going back to, you know, getting a junior dev, being able to mold them is important, but it's definitely not what all companies are looking for.
Yeah, so that's pretty much all my interview esque stuff. Oh, I guess one last thing is that after I interview, I type something up about the strengths and weaknesses. I don't just leave it in the back of my head. and I send it to the recruiter. I don't know if they ever get the feedback, but I always try to do that because I never get any. I've done hundreds of interviews. I think the only feedback I've gotten is one time, and it wasn't very good.
I like the feedback. I definitely, when I'm done with interviewing someone, I usually have a meeting with my manager, and then a lot of times the recruiter maybe wants feedback information too, and we'll provide it to them. I will say this is a sticky wicket, like feedback on interviews. I think the problem is that, at least in the United States, there is a big deal with giving people feedback on interviews, because if you're not careful, it could sound like you're not hiring someone because of something about them, like their age or what they look like or things like that. So most companies prefer not to give any feedback to candidates because it could lead to lawsuits, or it could lead to people thinking they were discriminated against, which may not be true. So at least if a good recruiter or a good company, if you don't get the job, they may give you some general feedback. I think some general feedback like, hey, you just need to, you know, you don't have enough experience. I think that's an okay feedback. It's going to feel kind of crappy for the person who gets it, that they'll be like, well, what the hell does that mean? But I think, fortunately, there's nothing companies can do nowadays without, you know, really opening themselves up to lawsuits.
Yeah, it's just the shit of living in America a little bit at times. But what are you going to do? I can only do what I can do. So what they choose to do with the information, gotta leave it to the business people to decide.
I'll say one other thing too, just kind of wrap up my thoughts on interviews, is, you know, if you're listening to this and you're going to interview, make sure that you show up on time. There are some little things that you can do. Show up on time. I think once you're late by more than a minute or two, it looks really poorly upon you. That really bothers me, especially, you know, if you have three or four people waiting for a candidate and they're very late, it's really annoying. Now in the time of COVID, it's even easier to get on your interviews because you're not worrying about traffic or driving somewhere. Most people are just doing all this stuff online. So if you can't get to your computer by a certain time, you know, it's really looks poorly on you. I would also say that being open, having a good attitude, don't get too emotional during your interviews. I'd say be confident. We already touched on that point. Have a good attitude and just do a few minutes of research. Like if you're going for a web development position, do a few minutes research. Take Dylan's 100 interview question challenge Udemy course.
There you go.
Make sure you can answer those. Obviously, it's not, you may not get those questions, but it's probably not a bad idea to do those. Just to learn some fundamentals so you can answer the questions. There's so many times where I interview someone and I really, really want them to pass. And then they can't make it to the next level because they just didn't understand the fundamentals, which is too bad. And it doesn't happen always. Sometimes just we have a better candidate and that's why they didn't get the position, but sometimes because they didn't know the fundamentals. And also, I would say another quick tip would be have a list of questions you want to ask at the end of your interview. So come up with some questions that you can ask me and be frank and honest with the questions that you have. I would say be careful about some questions. You don't want to ask too personal or probing questions. You don't want to ask weird questions about, like, you know, what are some things you hate about this job or some things that are negative. I would stay away from negative topics or negative questions if you're asking questions to your interviewer. And then also realize that, you know, it's not my fault if you don't get the job. So don't contact me on social media afterwards. Don't try to follow up with me or add me on LinkedIn. You know, I'm sorry that, you know, these things happen. You can't always get it. Just those are the things off the top of my head I can think of. And realize it's going to be a numbers game for a lot of people. You're going to have to, you might have to apply for 10, 15 places before you get a yes. And sometimes if you're a junior developer, it could be hundreds of places. Just keep that in mind. Do you want to talk about next season?
Yeah. I'm still in the works. We're wrapping up. I guess once this goes out, it's wrapped up at that point. Sounds like we're going to take a little bit of a break to be decided how long that is, and then get back to it. Season three.
Yeah. So what do you think? What are you going to be doing during your break? Maybe you can.
So I'm going to be moving. Some of you guys have may heard that I've talked about going to Salt Lake in the past. That's probably going to be happening. I'm listing my house for sale in the next couple of weeks. So just moving, getting situated, wrapping up some courses. I did a lot of stuff for Scrimba and LinkedIn Learning, and I think I'm going to take some time just to chill. So it'll be nice. Maybe, turn my six pack into a 12 pack, get sort of in shape a little bit. But yeah, just, just enjoy a little bit of time off, I think.
Yeah, I think definitely a little bit of time off is good. Me and Dylan both do these podcasts like basically whenever we have time on the weekends. A lot of times we give up time with our families and girlfriends and friends to do these podcasts. So it is quite a bit of time on our hands. And now with Dylan moving, it's going to be kind of harder. I know for the next few months, I'm going to be just working on my YouTube channel, something I've kind of been neglecting for a while. Kind of lost the passion a little bit on that. So I'm going to just be focusing on YouTube, and maybe I have a course, a new Vue.js course kind of brewing in my head that I may want to release. I also have my Vue 360 course that I'm going to start looking into and releasing that probably in the fall. I want to re-record some videos for that. But so I think what we're saying is that we'll probably take a couple months off. I'm not sure how long, but if you want to keep following our journeys, I think you can both check out our YouTube channels. I know Dylan's probably still, even though he's super busy, you're going to still be posting weekly on your YouTube, or?
Yeah, definitely. Always.
Yeah. So I think even he's going to be doing his Q&As, giving updates on his life, things like that. So what's your YouTube channel at?
YouTube.com/CodingTutorials360.
Cool. Yeah. And I'll be at Eric.video, or Program with Eric. You can look at, just search in YouTube for Program with Eric. You can find my YouTube channel, and I'll probably still be doing videos on Vue.js and stuff like that. So it's been definitely fun. We're hoping next season, just kind of me and Dylan haven't talked about it that much, but we might want to mix up it more often. We're probably going to try to do some more interviews. We're definitely looking to grow the podcast too. I think that's one thing that we really want to do, is that we want to try to get more sponsors. We want to basically have this podcast paid for either by our viewers using Patreon or something like that, or just sponsors, because we found like the editing and the time it takes, we kind of need to be paid back a little bit. Obviously it's always going to be free. So if you're listening right now and you made it all the way to the end of this podcast, awesome. Don't worry. You're never going to have to pay for it, but we're definitely looking at ways to just kind of make it a little bit more worth our time to get things paid for. So if you guys have any suggestions on that and you're still listening, I'd say, tweet me at EricCH, E-R-I-K-C-H on Twitter. And just let me know if you have any suggestions or ideas, and just mention that you listened to episode 24 on season 2 of the podcast. And, you know, we'd love to hear like ways we can kind of crowdsource this, bring more. I'd love to bring like a listener on, like maybe every few weeks, like maybe next season we could do like a listener special and just interview listeners, see what they're struggling with, seeing what, you know, what problems that they're having, and maybe we can even help them. I'm just kind of thinking, we're just kind of brainstorming ideas like that for next season.
Yeah, I think it'll be fun. I think we'll experiment a little, try some other things and jump around. I like to, you know, part of the cool things about having side projects like podcasts, anything else, is that they're yours. So do what you want with them. And if you want to try something new and see if you enjoy doing it.
Yep, I think so. So signing off for the last time of season 2. Thanks everybody for listening. I really appreciate it. I hope to see you in a few months. I'm not going to say exactly when. It's going to be an indefinite amount of period of time, but we will be back.
Yeah,
hopefully.
And don't. No one suggests we're not getting OnlyFans. I know that's how all the kids are making their money nowadays. It ain't happening. All right.
The OnlyFans? Yeah.
We'll leave it on that. See you guys season 3.
Later.
Hey guys, thanks for watching. If you want to find more about what I'm up to, go to dylanisrael.com.
And if you want to know what I'm up to, you can check out my website at eric.video. If you haven't already, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. It really helps us out. And if you do, you might even be featured on our next episode. Don't forget to check out the website at selftaughtornot.com. From there, you can sign up for a mailing list where we give away free courses and a bunch of cool stuff. And we'll also let you know when the next episode comes out. And finally, if you didn't know, we have a Facebook group. It's called Code, Tech, and Caffeine. We have over 10,000 members, and you can find the link at selftaughtornot.com. So come join us. We have tons of developers willing to help you guys, mentor you guys. Check it out. Just make sure you go to selftaughtornot.com and check out the Code, Tech, and Caffeine link. Thanks, and take care.